Penguin Random House Audio presents You're a Miracle and a Pain in the Ass, embracing the emotions, habits, and mystery that make you, you. This is the author, Mike McHarg. Note to listeners, this program includes a downloadable PDF that contains images from the book. For Rachel Held Evans, who helped me and millions of others find home. In times of stress, the best thing we can do for each other is to listen with our ears and our hearts and to be assured that our questions are just as important as our answers. Fred Rogers, The World According to Mr. Rogers. Author's note. You don't want to skip this one. Dear reader, last spring I watched a butterfly emerge from its cocoon in my front garden. I was struck by how it struggled. The tiny creature often stopped, presumably out of exhaustion, even on this critical threshold of its metamorphosis from a caterpillar to a creature that can soar through the air. At times, I was concerned it wouldn't make it at all. Forgive me if this seems presumptuous, but I think I know how the little bug felt. In many ways, this book is my own cocoon, spun from words and paper instead of silk. A couple of years ago, when I started writing it and exploring the science of why we struggle to change our behavior, I was self-assured in a peculiar way, finding confidence not in my mastery of life, but in my capacity to surrender to it. But life has a way of challenging the stories we tell ourselves to survive, and the past 18 months have been a metamorphosis for me. I have been through loss and grief, a medical diagnosis, a mental health crisis, and lost all the money I spent a lifetime saving. If you're going to listen to this book, you and I will spend many hours together, and for that to work, I have to be honest with you at the beginning. This is a dangerous book. The process of researching and applying its insights from psychology and sociology to neuroscience and behavioral economics changed my life in dramatic and unexpected ways. There has been pain, struggle, and loss. In the hours that follow, I'm going to be honest about what I've learned in the hope that it might help anyone else who's fighting to emerge from their own cocoon. Parts of this book could be tough to listen to, depending on how your life has unfolded. I write about my experiences with trauma and suicidal thoughts, and if you've got some scar tissue, my stories may bring up pain. You'll find that the opening of the book sets the stage for honesty. Take a break if you need it. You can pause this recording anytime you'd like. I've included ample resting points in the flow of the story to help. I'll be here in this recording whenever you need me, so there is no need to rush. Finally, while the stories I tell in this book are based on real events, I've sometimes reordered them, combined separate events together, and offered my recollections of what other people said, all for the sake of time and readability. Consider them based on a true story, as they say across town in Hollywood. I'm so excited to share this book with you. Peace, Love, Entropy. Mike McHarg or Science Mike, Los Angeles, California, 2019. 1. Why did I do that? The battle of you versus you. The barrel of a shotgun tastes like pocket change and fireworks. The flavor is overwhelming, like a battery pressed to your tongue, though the taste and aroma are quickly matched by the discomfort of what it takes, physically, to put such an instrument in your mouth. After placing the stock of the weapon on the ground, you lean forward and awkwardly bow your head, as if in prayer. If your goal is suicide, and it must be, or why else are you pointing a shotgun at your head, you want to make sure as much shot as possible passes through your brain. So still leaning forward, you lift your forehead into a less penitent posture. The result is pain, with the barrel smashing against your teeth and jabbing into the gums behind them. Shotguns are called long guns for a reason. With the barrel in your mouth, you can't reach the trigger while maintaining the critical head-to-barrel angle. My solution to this problem was improvised. I slipped off my right shoe and put my toe on the trigger. Doing so stretched my hip flexors uncomfortably and put strain on my knee. I've never liked pain, but I could cope with this discomfort. In a few seconds, I wouldn't feel anything ever again. I was 16 years old and tired of pain, rejection, and fear. My heart ached so much and so constantly that I didn't want to have a heart anymore. So here I was, sitting in my parents' bedroom with my father's hunting gun in my mouth. I took a deep, smoky, metallic breath and pushed the trigger with my toe. I felt the clunk even more than I heard it. It reverberated through my teeth and into my skull. I'll never forget that feeling, the ultimate anticlimax. Confusion washed over me, bordering on panic. How was I alive? Turns out, I'd cocked the gun successfully, but hadn't loaded it right. I was saved by my ignorance of guns and too afraid to try again. My heartbeat hit triple digits as I fell on the brown carpeted floor and sobbed. I hadn't been an obvious candidate for a suicide attempt. I was a lanky teenager who played in a band and had a lot of friends. My parents loved me and provided a lifestyle that was comfortably middle class. I had a car and everything. My life looked about as stable and secure as adolescents can be. Lying on the floor that day, I couldn't believe that I'd pulled the trigger. Taking one's own life goes against some of our most powerful instincts, those for living and self-preservation. This is why, when someone attempts suicide, the most obvious response for the people closest to them is to ask the unanswerable question, why? For people like me, however, those who have survived suicide attempts, there's an additional, equally puzzling question. Did I really want to die? The answer seems clear. After all, I'd put a loaded gun in my mouth and pulled the trigger. But if I'd really wanted to die, why hadn't I picked up the shotgun, troubleshooted the problem, and then tried again? How could I want to die badly enough to pull a trigger once, but not twice? Why, instead, did I lie on the floor full of grief and shame, lamenting that I had failed even at killing myself, while feeling thrilled by the tears on my cheeks because those tears meant I was still alive? How could I be happy at the same time I wished to be dead? My struggle over suicide was life or death. My feelings warred with themselves, fighting in equal measure for another breath and a final one. But who was I struggling with? I was the only one in the room. On the morning I write this, the California sun streams into the bedroom I share with my wife, Jenny. Our dogs have started to prance around the foot of our bed, anxious for us to wake up. They're older dogs with gray muzzles and a love of naps. They're mellow enough not to bark or jump on the bed, but they've learned that their nails make a ceaseless click-clack on the hardwood floor that reliably breaks the slumber of their human roommates. Time to get up, they say, as politely as a canine can muster. This year has brought a lot of change to my family. One of the smaller changes was moving across the country from Florida to California. Jenny and I had both lived in Tallahassee our entire lives, and it's hard to imagine a bigger change than moving from our sleepy southern hometown to a city like Los Angeles. The move has been both thrilling and exhausting. A megacity has a lot more things to do, but somehow far fewer places to park. I often cope with stress by eating, and LA is more than happy to enable me. I've been packing on the pounds while at home and packing them on while I travel for events. It's a bad cycle. So last night, I decided that I would take a walk when I woke up. I love going for walks.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?